Well, good evening and welcome to this evening's event, and to those of you who come from outside, welcome to the LSE. This is the fourth public debate in the series that the Arts and Social Sciences think tank in the LSE has been running. The debate tonight is on arts and science, the challenge of the unknown, and we're extremely lucky and privileged to have three wonderful speakers with us this evening. Robert Riven, who's sitting on my left, most immediate left, who is an artist. Richard Sennett, who is on the faculty at the LSE. And Martin Freeth, who has had a distinguished career in broadcasting. Now, one of the key issues for the Arts and Social Sciences think tank has been how to find a common language in which to discuss the issues that concern us. And tonight we're moving into a domain, I think, where the arts and sciences have something already in common, which is the way that they do deal with the unknown. The social sciences, I think, are a little different in the sense that we tend to deal most immediately with the things that are in front of us. However, I think part of the issue tonight is about innovation and about creativity. And I think that these and others will be the themes of the discussion. What will happen is that each of our speakers will speak for about 12 or 15 minutes, show you some material, raise issues, and so on. And then we will open the floor to you and have a general debate. We will finish, as usual, at 7 o'clock, and there will be drinks upstairs on the fifth floor, and you're all very welcome to join us afterwards. So I'd like to begin then by introducing Robert Riven, who is an artist whose work has been specifically concerned with the borderlands or the hinterlands or the relationships, as he will explain to you, between arts and science. He has been recently working with NASA using images collected by the famous Hubble telescope. Some of his earlier work was concerned with problems of complexity, with probability, with ways of understanding the universe and the ways of understanding humans within that larger universe or cosmos. So, Robert, I'd like to welcome you and ask you to talk to us.
Well, thanks very much. As I say, I'm a visual artist, and I'm also head of a fine art course at Portsmouth University. And I also run a art on science research centre at Portsmouth as well, where we do strange things. What I've been asked to do is give you sort of a potted history of my work with art and science, the combination of the two. Now, I'm going to plunge you all into darkness in a moment, so this is probably the last you're going to see of me for a few minutes, and because I'm going to show you some slides. There we go. Sorry, there's a complicated device up here for My work is primarily concerned with our perceptions and notion of reality. My early work in the area was to do with cultural and religious views of reality, primarily Taoist, Buddhist concepts of reality, and the Australian Aboriginal concepts of dreams and reality. However, there were interesting things going on in the field of science that I thought I ought to know about, and I started a serious study of the subject in 1993. This piece here is the reduced Einstein equations and daffodils from 1994. It was one of the first pieces that I made. And it's about the very different views of reality, from one being a poet and one being a scientist, but they're both actually discussing very similar things. The initial research was primarily from books, and the artwork that I produced reflected this as it developed as very text-based artwork. This piece is called Probability and a Multiple Universe, and it was made in 1995. And it was from another exhibition that I did. And it's to do with multi-universe theory. When I started this, I decided to research into the main revolutions of science of this century. These are namely relativity theory, quantum theory, and chaos theory. I was particularly interested in new scientific views of reality and new notions of space, time, matter, energy, waves, and probability. This piece is also to do with the multi-universe theory, and it's a theory that is I perturbs me a great deal, actually, and I did a whole series on it. This is a piece called Energy, Mass, Probability, Waves, and Erwin Schrödinger's Cat. This is based on the Erwin Schrödinger's probability wave theory, quite a famous sort of scientific textbook visual experiment, mental experiment. This initial research from books was very informative. However, I felt a need to do some observational work from reality. I found that chaos theory, I was more able to do this. And also the scientific approach of a scientist like Richard Fernaman was much closer to my way of working. I was now out of the library and back in the observable reality of sea, clouds, sunshine, stars. A lot of artists work from observation, and it's one of our major areas. And the working from books was all very well, but I really had this need to get back out and touch reality again. This piece is called, I'll just focus that a bit better. It's called Go With The Flow, and it's from 1996. At this point, I'd become very interested in the nature of probability, waves, and events. I wanted to understand and know them more personally, to empathize with them, to know what they felt like, to know them as an artist. I studied waves in the sea, and I moved on to study waves left in the sand. These pieces are castings of beaches, and there was a whole series of these. This piece is called A Linear Euclidean Grid in a Non-Linear Universe, and it's from the same exhibition. My exhibition, Probability of Waves and Events, developed from this, where I engaged with some of the puzzles of chaos theory. This was particularly concerned with aspects of probability, waves, and events in relation to linear Euclidean geometric structures and non-linear aspects of natural structures. This area has a lot to play with mathematics as well as science. It's almost this, so this is where really mathematics, science, and art come together. This piece is called the Euclidean Conditioning Grid. The work for this exhibition was also concerned with fractals, the butterfly effect, reflectophores, feedback, and scaling, which are different ways of looking at our universe through chaos theory and fractal geometry, as opposed to our traditional Euclidean geometry. I'll focus this up again. Oops. This piece is called Meditations on Complexity, and it's a painting from a series I did in 1997. These paintings are concerned with complexity theory. The paintings are a product of the complex working of the inner self. They are created using the intuitive spirit to control the process of making a painting, similar to the Zen art of meditative sumi-e painting. There's another one here from the same series. However, in these paintings, there is no quest for predetermined pictorial reality. The work develops an intense relationship between my intuitive desires, chance events, and feedback from the developing painting on the canvas. These paintings were made under the same conditions, using the same colours, same brushes, and each one was produced in a day over a series of weeks. There was no predetermined conscious plan when I started them, just the same painting rule. So I was trying to sort of emulate a chaotic, a complex or a chaotic theory situation where I was nature itself and these were my marks. And each day, of course, the paintings came out differently, just as the sand patterns on a beach are different every day because of the same sort of organizational structure. Moving on now to 1996. This piece is called Three Triangles. The work with chaos theory and complexity theory and notions of probability and events from quantum theory drew me to an interest in patterns created by natural interacting events on a global and universal scale. The work that I developed with waves in the sea and patterns on beaches led me first to the effects of the moon and then into deep space. The resulting exhibition was Improbable Events in 1998, an exhibition of artwork created for the internet. All these pieces were made digitally and were for exhibition on the internet, and they were designed to actually be seen on screen. The exhibition consists of a series of digitally manipulated images, collage from my paintings, photographs, and NASA photographs of distant star clusters from the Hubble telescope. The subject of the work explores theories of complexity and probability in our universe by observing and contemplating the images of transient complex events. They are about scale and time of my painting in relation to the time and scale of sand waves and the relation of those to the huge and ancient images of the Helix Nebula. In these things, I was getting particularly interested in the ideas of scale and what it felt like, and also in time. And we have here paintings which happen in a day, which have been cut into strips. And also the background is another painting. We have a sand wave, which is, again, transient. It comes and goes every time the sea comes in and goes out, which is affected by the moon. And they're sort of on a human scale. And then we have these little triangles down here. And the content of those is several million miles across. And they're also millions of years old. So we have this thing that I was trying to get my head around about time and space and how it feels to me. Whoops. My artistic journey into space brought about a new direction in my work involving observing and including spacegate patterns and structures in my paintings. At this time, I was collaborating with the astrobiologist Dr. Andrew Steele, a scientist working on the NASA's Mars space program. At this time, I became very interested in the notion of reproduction and evolution of life in the universe, as suggested in the panspermia theory. The outcome of this collaboration was my exhibition Mars in 1999. The initial works have been created digitally. They are a collage of paintings, drawings, and reworked and manipulated photographs from the Hubble telescope and exploratory Mars satellites. The work also contains reworked and manipulated electron microscope images of ancient and possible extraterrestrial life forms. After that, I did a series of paintings about the subject. This is the first of those. The second stage of the Mars work are paintings which have been developed from the initial work. These paintings are painted in acrylic on oil and oil on board and are painted in an intuitive manner in an attempt to capture the feeling and thoughts of the subconscious. So where I become totally immersed in the research for it, doing it digitally with photographs and things, here I was working intuitively, just letting things out of the subconscious, which I didn't necessarily understand and in many ways still don't, but they evolve. It's a way that I like working. My present work is still concerned with the subject of my previous work. However, I'm now focusing on the relationship between perception, interpretation, and memory of new information as its relation to our view of the universe. This concern is centered on the notion of our universe that we think of being constructed within our mind from memory. This, I feel, has important implications relating to the way we perceive and interpret new information about our universe. I am in the process of preparing two new projects for 2000 and 2001. Reaching for the Stars, a Year of the Artist project sponsored by Southern Arts and the Arts Council of Great Britain, and Painting Data. That's it. Thank you very much. I'll see if I can put the lights back on.
Right, well, thank you very much, Robert, and particularly led me to think about problems of space and time and the different ways in which the sciences and the arts and the social sciences think about space and time, and particularly about things like complexity and probability. I have a shrewd sense that complexity, at least as far as social anthropologists are concerned, means something quite different from that term when it's used by scientists looking through the Hubble telescope. But I think we should move on and listen to Richard Sennett, who's our next speaker this evening. Richard Sennett needs very little introduction from me. He is a sociologist, an urban designer, a musician, and I think something of a philosopher. He's written many books, both fiction and non-fiction, that is serious academic study and fiction, for which I rather envy him. I always envy people who produce both fiction and serious academic study. He's going to talk tonight about a new project that he's been working on that's connected to the work of the American choreographer Merce Cunningham. Richard, please.
Do you mind if I sit? It's easier for me. I wanted to come talk to you about this project because it's a project about the theme of this particular meeting, which is the unknown. The kind of work that I'm doing on this project is one in which urban design, which is both an art and something of a social science, intersect. It's a project that I am elaborating with the architect Daniel Libeskind, and we're going to try and present it more formally at the Tate Gallery on March 18th. So you are my in-town tryout on this, and I'll be glad to get whatever kind of feedback you feel you can give me. To understand what we're doing, to tell you something about a kind of dilemma in urban design now. We are, as designers, caught between a Scylla and a Charybdis of the determinate and the indeterminate. The Scylla in this dilemma is that a great deal of modern urban design is purposely formless. If you think about a flexible office space in any building in London post 1980, it's a space that's designed to be quickly vacated and used by new tenants. It has very little marking to it. The space can be, as it were, disassembled like a stage set, something else erected very quickly. The notion of creating space of no character has a lot of economic value in very inflexible capitalism. It means that you haven't committed yourself to a physical object which can go out of use or which can be put out of date. The Charybdis, that other island of this dilemma, is the kind of building that also exists at the present time, which is super precise, which is overdetermined. It's a kind of building in which form rigidly follows function. Unfortunately, you in Britain know this, for instance, in the way in which housing estates are designed, in which I often imagine the designer has put a great big thumbprint on one spot and said, this will be the social space where people will interact. A lot of British planning law, and also planning law in my own country, follows this kind of super determination in which the planner tries to say exactly what will happen in a particular place and even at a particular time. And it's an incredible dilemma for urban designers. At one extreme, we're faced with a kind of economics of the formless, of the purposely formless. And at the other extreme, on this other horrible Greek island, faced with a kind of superdetermination, which comes out of the notion that social reality must be controlled in advance. And the question is how, for us as designers, people working both at the visual and the social level, we can break out of this kind of trap. I have to say that I had a long, I've had many long discussions with my friend and colleague Daniel Libeskind, who is an architect who is doing the addition to the V&A and has done the Jewish Museum in Berlin about this problem. And mostly what we just did is whinged and complained about this until we started talking about Merce Cunningham. Both of us are, I can't say obsessed, but nearly obsessed with the work of Cunningham as a choreographer. And that's because Cunningham is somebody who makes indeterminate forms, or more precisely, gives to his dancers the ability to create very specifically bodily movement of their own, based out of the choreographer's own very strict body syntax. It's as though you give a person a set of directions for what they might do and say, what you actually do will depend on what you're feeling like doing on stage. And it has seemed to us that in some way, the way in which Merce Cunningham, I don't know how many of you have seen his work, he now comes here almost every year, it's an enormous influence on both German and American artists of all kind. But somehow, out of this passion for this particular choreographer's work, we might find some clues for escaping being caught in this dilemma between the formless and the overdetermined. What I'd like to present to you tonight are just three ideas that we are trying to work out, as it were, with a kind of choreography of urban space. And I present them to you very simply. They have to do with the vertical, the horizontal, and the geographic. And let me tell you what we've been thinking about in each of those domains. In the vertical domain, we've been thinking about ways of spreading public space out through buildings, up. The conventions, one of the Charybdian, I guess you want to put it that way, overdeterminations of public space in most buildings is that it happens only on the ground. That you wouldn't go up 6 floors, for instance, to come to a theater like this. Or if you went to a restaurant at most, as in the Oxo Tower, you'd go all the way to the top. But that in the vertical layerings of a building, you don't discover public space. The Japanese do this, and it seemed to us that it provided a kind of recipe for looking at ways to, as it were, expand the public realm literally upwards. And it has all sorts of, and if you come on the 18th, you'll see some projects in which we tried to figure out, for instance, how do you take an elevator to an unknown place, which is called the public realm. There's all sorts of technical issues which are both difficult and fascinating. But the idea about it is to make more indeterminate where the public is in a building, but to make an actual public to exist. A second way in which we've been playing with the notion of giving a recipe for something that's in its working out indeterminate has to do with the horizontal realm. We've been interested in the way in which the users of buildings might make forms within horizontal space. Now you know intuitively what I'm talking about user-made forms. When you think about the pictures of dogs, children, loved ones of whatever sex, that you have those photographs that you have on your desk. It's a way of putting a marking saying, this is actually my space, I've made something here. In the urban dimension, it's possible to do that as well. And one of the things I've been thinking about in particular is how to adapt the self-building techniques that are used in a lot of third world urbanism. That is where you give somebody a pile of bricks, some cement, some steel pipes, and say, and tear down your shack, and here are the materials to build a house whatever way you want. I've been thinking about how that kind of building technology could be adapted, in fact, to those very flexible offices so that people could actually construct rooms, corridors, offices, even something more elaborate like apartments, out of very simply furnished materials that we give to the people who actually use them. One of the interesting things about this project, this kind of self-building and horizontal space, very hard to build vertically in this way because the engineering is too difficult. But what we found from the experiments in doing this in developing world cities and favelas and shantytowns and so on, is a very curious phenomenon. That when people are given the opportunity to build this way, they tend to crowd together rather than stretch out. They want to find ways of creating adjacency, nearness, relationship to the people. One of the things that has therefore really intrigued me about the whole project of horizontal user-made forms is that they create new kinds of clusterings between people that are dense and maybe even very efficient. So that is a second project that we're pursuing, and as I say, on the 18th, I'll show you what some of that actually looks like. A third issue is geographic, and it has to do with the center edge. And here, just recall to you, if you don't know it, something about how Cunningham deals with stage space. One of the things he's the most famous for is the decentering of the stage frame. so that things will happen as if by accident on the edge of the frame. When you look at the way this stage frame is set up, we're put dead center, right, to indicate the importance of what we're saying to you. Cunningham would have put one of us here, maybe one of us up there, and maybe one of us down in front, as a way of saying that something's being made in that space, which doesn't have to do with centrality. That things, interesting things happen when you get to the edge. I've been looking at the parallel to that in social places in a community. For instance, how you displace things to the edges of communities rather than work at the center of a geographic community. How you break out the boundaries of saying if a community has an identity, it must be located at its center. And I've been, I guess, motivated to think in a Cunningham-like way out of probably the greatest planning disaster in my own career. In the 1980s, I helped create something called La Marqueta in New York City, which is a Spanish market and for Spanish Harlem in New York. We put it dead center in the community of Spanish Harlem, far away from the edge where Spanish Harlem abuts, which is one of the poorest communities in the world, abuts one of the richest, which is the Upper East Side. We could have put this community on 96th Street, we put it on 116th Street to be in the center of the community. This market, this social market, turned out it collapsed economically because it didn't have enough draw, didn't have enough people coming to it. And socially it collapsed because there was very little interweave with the rest of the city. And it's that kind of thinking about displacement to the edge, which I wish I had actually done in this disastrous event. I cite these three examples of vertical, horizontal, and geographic ways of playing with the indeterminate, because essentially in urban design, what we have got to do is find ways of shocking ourselves into a sense of presence. Urban design is only going to get better socially when it gets to be more innovative as an art. And in my view, the only way it can really begin to innovate as an art is when it plays with that boundary line between the known and the unknown, the determined and the indetermined, that space, if you like, in between Scylla and Charybdis. And that's what this project is about.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard. Strikes me a very interesting issue about the relationship between design, conscious activity, and the way that conscious activity is projected onto the world, and problems about randomness and unpredictability of human action. But one thing that seemed to link what Richard was saying with what Robert was speaking about was the idea that things happen on the edge somewhere, some space between the known and the unknown. Perhaps that's a theme that we'll pick up later in the conversation. I'd like to introduce now Martin Freeth, who in a sense will continue this theme about edges, because he's going, I think, in some ways to talk about frames. Martin is a distinguished BBC television science producer and executive. For those of you who have lived in the UK for any period of time, you will certainly have seen Horizon or Tomorrow's World or the Burke Special, and we have Martin to thank for all of those programs and for the particular and very innovative way in which they framed science for a mass public, for issues, I think, about how to get public participation and science together in some way or other. He's now Deputy Chief Executive of NESTA, which is the lottery-funded National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts, and is involved in issues to do with education, multimedia, and IT.
Martin. Thanks very much, Harriet. Is this supposed to be live, this control screen, since
should
I need
be?
To run some videos and it seems to be blanked out?
Robert probably knows how to make it function.
thank you. Very good. I needed an artist.
You might need
video. Video, yes, video, thank you.
And nothing happens.
Where's the... No, I think we just have to wait.
It may take a moment.
I don't think so. Where's the technician?
Video. Well, he'd be loading the videos. I'd better start.
Yes, the technician is there, I can see him. So perhaps you should talk first.
As I... What is his name, please? Technician.
Is it Ray? Is it Ray up there? Ray,
I'm sorry, what I'm getting is I press video and nothing happens. And since I'm showing three videos... this would be a problem.
He's saying talk.
There we are.
Continue.
Oh, good. Yeah, but I still don't have control here of those videos, which I need when we get going.
I think you will have, he's saying.
Okay. Well, in that case... I want to start running the first images right now.
Okay.
Sorry about this.
I better get out of the way, isn't it?
While we're waiting to get control of this, when Henrietta used the term frames, there was a book written by a sociologist. I was going to say who should be nameless, but he's actually a professor of media here, Roger Silverstone, in which he spent earlier in his career... off and on, during the course of a year, following me round as I made a Horizon documentary about the Green Revolution. And he called it Framing Science, the Making of a BBC Documentary. And I have to say, it's made me run away from sociologists ever since, because it was a very perceptive study of the constraints acting on me, the deals I was doing consciously and unconsciously with my contributors, and the fact that I wasn't anything like the sort of free agent I thought I was in creating this particular scenario. Now, I really do need Ray's help to get this video going, since I do depend on three video clips I want to show. Previous page. Slide selected. That won't do. No, that's the slide controller. So, if I go to video... I should now have some control of that, I would have thought. Is he in the box?
Yes, he is.
Can he talk to us, please? I'll tell you a little bit about what the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts while I wait for the first video. It's one of the very few organisations whose brief actually includes supporting projects that bring science and arts together. The other two that I know of that are significant in this area, the Wellcome Trust and the Gulbenkian Foundation, which both look for projects that link science and arts. I'm going to talk to you a bit about some of the Wellcome Trust funded and now Nestor-funded SciArt projects in a moment. Now, Nestor's existed for a year or so in the sense that we've been getting premises, recruiting staff, and most particularly going through the process of getting our processes of fund-giving audited by the National Audit Office and other elements of the civil service. This has proved to be a daunting prospect, but we think we're now cleared for takeoff, and in a month or two there will be announcements of a number of projects, some of which do specifically link science and arts, that Nestor's going to fund. Nestor has three programs. The fellowships program is money for individuals who are very innovative in their field, who we would hope would stay in the UK to develop their field. And the second program is inventions and innovation, which again gives small projects between £20,000 and £70,000 to develop over 1 to 3 years. And those we invest in projects sort of prior to the business angels stage, as it were, in the hope of developing them to the point where venture capitalists will look at them further. And finally, there are education projects that can be done in collaboration with existing organizations. and which we kind of cherry-pick and, to use the auditor's term, solicit from the world and do in partnership with others, and which are about the ways of developing creative and innovative talent. And those three programs, the Inventions program is up and running already, and the Fellowships program we have nominations in, which will be announced soon, and Education we're working on now. Now, I still, Ray, don't have control of these videos, but do run this in the background if you would. I think I'll have to ask you to control each one. Now, the images which we're about to see now, I think we may have... Oh, no, here we go. These are images generated, produced by William Latham, who's not only... formally would describe himself as an artist.
It's not a new thing, of course, the use of technology in art. I mean, if you think about it, many of you here will...
Excuse me, we better stop this tape, because although it was parked in the right place, it has now been moved to a different place, I think. Help. Okay, can you stop this tape now, please, and put in the second tape? We'll go straight to the second tape in a few minutes. The sorts of images that you were seeing, however, which I wanted to show you for much longer, are generated not directly by William Latham, but by the mathematics in his computer that he has fed in the equations for, and also by a number of biological rules drawn from ideas and knowledge of how evolution works. So that the other things that William Latham has developed involve, for example, creating buildings by... Yes, don't run the next tape yet, please. He's been, for example, putting in designs for buildings, very schematic designs, admittedly, and letting the buildings breed with one another to see what the product of that breeding would be. And you see a whole range of completely novel buildings you wouldn't have thought of before. He's done the same for the perfume industry with perfume bottle designs, letting them breed and seeing what happens. And he's also creating computer games directly for the mass games market, in which you explore all sorts of landscapes, but in which there is artificial intelligence driving your competitors and the other elements in the game. Now, just before I introduce some of the SciArt projects, which I think are quite important in the context of tonight's discussion, there's been a long debate since C.P. Snow about two cultures, and of course there are two cultures, and in my personal opinion there should be at least two cultures, probably many more than two cultures. Scientific methodology is and needs to be profoundly different from artistic thinking. The important point is that these cultures can talk to each other and benefit each other, and neither can claim to possess a higher kind of truth. But they are different, and when we look at SciArt partnerships, we look to see what people can gain from each other, rather than saying in some vague way that the creativity is all the same. It's in very important respects, I think, very different. Now, I want to talk a little bit about one of the products of science, which is in technology, interactive media, because one of the things I did after making Horizon programs was set up a BBC Multimedia Centre and helped to start BBC Online. And back then, which was only about 4 or 5 years ago, evangelist was a sort of dirty word in the BBC. But what we're seeing now is, as the hype claims, a genuine revolution, which, amongst other things, will permanently change the relationship between the authors of media and their audiences. It's a revolution created by the convergence of technical and creative skills, and it decisively lowers the barriers to entry and allows a much wider range of people to get involved, well, in lots of things, democratically in decision-making about science, and creating and distributing art and media of various kinds. Now, I want to run the second tape in a moment. This was created by an internet group who originally called themselves PaddyNet and decided that they would call themselves Iolantis instead. It was an Irish group. They didn't think PaddyNet was quite politically correct. And what they were trying to do was put people together online in order that they could play music with one another. This, at the time, was using ISDN lines about 2 years ago and software, PictureTel software. They were doing something which would have cost me as a television producer £100,000 to book satellite lines to make it to happen for a television programme, only two or three years before that. And they're doing something here which you'll see, which everybody will be able to do for almost no money. I don't mean no money in terms of getting people together if they want to play music or the cameras to film them, which can be pretty cheap but will cost something, but almost no money in terms of linking up on the internet three separate venues to create a living kind of popular art. Let's play the next tape, and this is the one, Ray, where I want to spin on in the middle and hoped I could control from here, but I will tell you when we get to the point where I want to spin on. If we could run it now with sound. Bring the sound right up, please. Can you take the lights down and bring the sound further up?
Waste is another man's goal, and the holy ground is a dead zone, and everybody's gone. Outside the world is spinning round. It really matters that you turn it on.
Excuse me, Ray, this tape was parked at exactly the right place, and this has been wound to a completely round. Different place on the tape.
It really matters that you turn it on. Gotta keep moving. Gotta dig what you're doing. See the road go on and on when it's something you believe in. We are all the same when we enter this world. Gotta keep moving. Gotta dig what you're doing. See the road go on and on when it's something you believe in. We are all the same when we enter this world. Gotta keep moving. Gotta think what you're doing. See the road go on and on when it's something you believe in.
Spin the tape backwards in vision, and I'll tell you when to stop.
When we enter this world.
I have to be able to see it while you're rewinding. Well, take it from me, the film Elsewhere. Yeah, try running that bit for a bit.
Being in the diaspora, you know, you're separate, you don't really meet people that often, and to have this living contact and exchange of ideas regularly through the internet, that would be something else, you know.
C'est ça qui est magique. Si ça avait été une conversation, ça aurait pas été magique. Là, c'est la musique.
We think that this virtual interaction is nearly as good as the real thing. No, better.
Maybe someone wants to say hello to the people. Allez, viens.
Where are you, honey? Happy St. Paddy's Day to you all back at home.
Je suis arrivé là par hasard et je trouve ça très drôle, quoi. C'est assez étonnant de pouvoir parler à des gens à 6-8 000 km d'ici, je trouve ça vachement bien.
Now the third tape really has to start at the right place, so if you could put the third tape in, I hope it hasn't been wound in any way, I'd be very grateful. Now in the wider arena beyond the digital revolution, what can science gain from the arts? What can the arts gain from science, and what can emerge when they get together? Nesta has become a major contributor, as I said, to the SciArt competition, which started about 3 years ago. I'm just going to give you the flavour of some of the projects which Welcome and Now We have funded. The wellness collection will develop smart fabrics to incorporate interactive delivery systems in clothes. It will lead to revolutionary ways of displaying fragrance and, in the longer term, of delivering medication. Another one, the errant eye, is the construction of an immersive shared virtual reality environment that will be used to explore functions of the brain associated with deficiencies in memory, sensation, perception and expression. The errant eye is a work from the Einstein's Brain Project. Then Colorscape is the design and construction of a walk-in color environment, a colorscape that can be used in furthering an understanding of color therapy. Chemical portraiture is the design and production of an instrument that will optimize odor analysis, contributing to advancements in the art, science, and technology of smell. The painter's eye movements, this is involving John Chalenko, and was actually demonstrated in the National Portrait Gallery. The development of a new piece of equipment, the eye-hand tracker, to advance our knowledge of how the eye sees, the brain transforms, and the hand produces. And what he was looking at is how artists, when doing a drawing of a person, look at that person. The production of a 30-minute video, this is revealing phantoms in the brain, documenting visually for the first time the range of dynamic phenomenological characteristics experienced by patients with phantom limbs, and so on. Now, the most interesting, perhaps one of the most interesting projects, which I want to describe to you, is this project Primitive Streak that was developed by the fashion designer Helen Story and her scientist sister. And we discussed this at one of Nesta's launch events last year when Jude Kelly from the West Yorkshire Playhouse presented it. And she was accompanied by Helen Story and by a scientist from Pfizer's who later got involved with Helen's work, called Jill Samuels. So you'll see a small snatch of them talking, and then you'll see a film, just a few minutes, which describes this particular project, which I think is one of the most illuminating of the PSYOP projects. So if we could, hoping the tape is in the right place, run the tape from where it is and turn the lights down and sound up.
...to do. But I suppose you could say the three of us, theatre director, ex-fashion designer and now explorer, and pharmacologist and policy science maker, we're all wrapped up in doing some fairly new things that we've never tried before, and I can tell you it's very frightening. We're going to start by watching a film. I'd like to thank UK Films for doing this for us. It's a film which covers the story, the beginning of the story of Primitive Streak, which was Helen's last project that she worked on with her sister Kate Story, and then with Jill Samuels. And the film is self-explanatory, and after that I'm going to talk to Helen and Jill about the genesis of it. So we're just going to put the film on. I think it's about 3 or 4 minutes long.
The worlds of high fashion and of medical science might seem to have little in common. But two sisters have contrived to change all that. Dr. Kate Story is a research biologist at Oxford University. She's studying chick embryos to learn more about how cells communicate in the process of creating the body. Her sister, Helen Story, is one of Britain's top international fashion designers, with such clients as Cher and Liz Hurley.
So what I've done, Kate, is I've taken the DNA gel that you gave me in Oxford, and I've given it to...
Together, the sisters decided to bridge the worlds of art and science by collaborating on a fashion collection inspired by Kate's research.
Have a lot of colour, either on a black ground or a white ground, to things that are much simpler, red on black or white on black or black on white.
Launched at London's Institute of Contemporary Arts, their Primitive Streak collection is a fashion interpretation of the first 1,000 hours of human life.
In many ways, going into the lab for the first time was a bit like attending your first biology class. It was a mixture of both very daunting but very exciting.
So this is lots of sperm swimming around, and you can see about the highly motile cell. They're all trying to digest their way into the egg, and obviously only one's got to be able to come in.
I don't know why, but for some reason, out of the sperm come hundreds of ideas. But I finally settled on trying to capture some of the nature of the fact that it's sperm and egg, and not isolating the two, is to create this kind of cage which a woman would actually wear.
What we wanted to do was take key events which we thought people would be familiar with, and then try and give them some more detail in terms of the way the embryo develops, in terms of the events that were taking place. And with the sperm and egg, for instance, we wanted to communicate the idea that, that one of the important characteristics of sperm is that they're a motile cell. And the cloak that Helen's designed blows in the wind, very much evoking this sense of movement.
They line up in pairs and then they separate so that each...
Every science fact had to be translated into fashion form. A cluster of cells implanted in the uterus wall is translated into symbolic science, a biological process embroidered on blood-red silk. The toughest test was explaining the critical stage when tissue forms that will evolve as body parts like heart and bone and muscle.
This is a primitive streak, which is one of the earliest structures to appear in the embryo, and is the sort of morphological manifestation of the head-to-tail axis of the embryo. And you can see it involves cells moving in to this lower region here, which is going to form, eventually be the tail region, and moving up towards what will be the head. This is how I finally interpreted primitive streak. I'm starting off with the head of the streak here, trying to sort of capture its head-to-tail axis going up the back of the dress. And by using this silver gauze, which represent this sheet of cells that pour in. People came and got all sorts of things out of the exhibition that I never imagined they would. There was science there to be had if they wanted, but there were all sorts of images and stimulating things in there as well. And people came away inspired to go perhaps and look at some science, perhaps to go and look at another design project themselves.
Thank you. If you could stop that tape now.
Great. Right.
Thank you.
Now, I remember when I first met Helen.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I'm sorry, this we did rehearse this controller and it did work, so I'm so sorry it packed up. And thanks very much for running the tapes. Now, there's a book just come out in the last day or two that I've only just received that I can strongly recommend to anybody who's interested in the themes that these sorts of partnerships explore. And that's by Sian Ead, and it's called Strange and Charmed, produced by the Kellogg's Gulbenkian Foundation. And it's got a foreword by A.S. Byatt. And I just want to read one paragraph from this to give you a real sense of how profound some of the issues that these partnerships can raise are. She says, "I believe the new images and understanding we're acquiring of the biology of consciousness will slowly change the forms of work of art in many disciplines. Colin Blakemore, writing in The Independent on Sunday on the new problems to be posed or solved by the study of the brain, says that neuroscience will undermine such cherished notions of spirituality in, spirituality, intuition, and altruism. Not by denying that people have them, but by providing rational accounts of them. Now, some artists react to this kind of perception by fierce and immediate defense of the notions. But I cannot believe that curiosity about the science will not be more illuminating than automatic, principled opposition to it. Just as understanding the complexity of genetic alterations will in the end surely produce not naively mocking potato-headed men or banana-tailed superlambs, but shifting metaphoric forms like Bernini's Daphne or Polka's witches and demons in caverns of poisonous and lovely pigments." So she's going to enjoy it. I worked with Colin Blakemore on a series called The Mind Machine, and we did a program called The Violent Mind, which sought to suggest that really we didn't have any free will at all because we were all a machine, etc., etc. And of course the question occurred to us that Colin couldn't have decided to do the series or chosen not to do it. So he absolutely had to do it. He was determined completely by his brain and mind. Of course, you can get complete absurd scientific determinism, which does, in my view, need to be challenged. But I think that what we are entering into is, because of the changes and developments in science and a growing connection between science and art, into some really exciting, if you like, unknown territory. And Nesta wants to take risks and to foster just those sorts of partnerships that raise the most interesting philosophical questions. And I'm keen to hear from anybody who has ideas for projects that bring these disciplines together. And social science, I suppose you could call a science. We can argue about that too. If you call it a science, then let's bring that together with the arts and think of some projects for Nesta that explore that terrain as well. And that's all I have to show at the moment.
Martin, thank you very much. I suppose it's only 20 plus years of experience of technical hiccups that give you the patience of Job in these circumstances. I must say I would have lost my way very early on indeed. So thank you very much for that. I think the three speakers coming together raise a number of issues. I don't want to prejudge the debate, even though I'd love to launch into something about the issues around intuition. But I think perhaps what we should do now is open discussion up to you on the floor, for you to interact a little bit with our three speakers. And do please direct questions either to individuals or to general themes as you'd like. Now, who would like to start? Yes. Yes.
I'm an artist. I've discovered that whereas the Arts Council and the other and regional arts boards used to do buying time grants, where you get a grant to survive on while you're making your artwork. When I last inquired about the terms under which you could apply for a grant, they mostly were talking about grants for research. Now most painters, you know, research is a sketchbook. You actually need a grant to keep the roof over your head while you're producing the work. And I wanted to ask, therefore, what kind of terms the Nesta grants are made on, whether they are buying time grants to allow artists to develop ideas and to actually make the work in connection with, you know, in liaison with whatever other people are concerned, or whether they are specifically restricted to grants for research purposes only, which then leave the artist high and dry without any resources to make the actual work.
Thank you for the question. The only research that we will fund will be research that we think will be useful in helping us make decisions about where to place our limited resources in the UK to generate the most creativity and innovation in the country. So most of our grants will not be for research. There are three funds. The one that you would like to receive, I'm quite sure, would be a fellowship, which would be a significant sum of money to buy time to develop your own ideas and talents. Those cannot be applied for generally because we have tiny staff and we cannot cope with thousands of applications for them. We do have a cohort of nominators dotted around Britain who will seek out talents and people with a lot of their best work ahead of them at any age and nominate them, and those people who are nominated will then be considered, and many of them will get such grants. And in order not to be accused of only supporting, say, one school of choreography, let's say, we'll change our nominator panel every few months so that another batch of people will get recommended for those grants. The second one are much more to do with products and productions, and they are the inventions program, and that is open to everyone to apply to on the website. We're only communicating to people electronically. I'm afraid we're sort of future-oriented in that regard. Again, it's a matter of resource. We can't send paper out. You can apply for those. And education projects are with institutions and bodies, and they are partnerships in particular projects to develop new ways of developing talent. So I think the one that applies to, you know, what you would ideally like to receive would be a fellowship from Nesta.
But you can't apply to those. You have to be known to the panel.
You have to be known to one of 100 nominators who change every 6 months that are dotted about the disciplines and dotted about the country. We have at the moment no other way of handling the volumes. Well, then we would get 10,000 applicants, which we couldn't process.
Yes, I'm sorry, but I think we should talk about how to get a grant over drinks, because this is a better thing. David.
Henrietta, I congratulate you on bringing three people here who demonstrated that education should be less about learning and more about exploring. Which I think is excellent. In every one of them, we saw a path there. It is useful, I think, though, as Richard said, to sort of hang it on a hook. And the city, since it's a living thing, which has all these elements, and it is as good a book as any practice festival. And I was fascinated by his talking about the centre and the edge and looking at the edge. What interests me about a city like London, Richard, is that in fact there is a kind of, like the water coming up the sand and the ripples, there is a kind of an ebb and flow that you see in cities. I remember one of your books actually talking about this, but not perhaps in that way. It seems to me very interesting with a city like London. In fact, it's back of what you were describing about the edge. The edge is constantly moving. Sometimes the edges are outside your front door. And city like London has gotten through in socially, economically, and in fact, emotionally. And sometimes they're larger, and it's constantly changing. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more about the way you state it was happening, or if you like the way it was 18.
Well, I feel a little, since I've lived in London now only 6 months, I feel slightly abashed in explaining your city to you. But nonetheless, what is interesting about this in terms of the theme of the unknown, is it very indeterminate ways in which actual edges between communities shift. We used to think that we had a pretty good way of predicting economically just how, as it were, kind of ecology changed, as though it were a formula. It doesn't turn out to work that way in actual space, whether one block or another block becomes the edge of, say, a racial divide. Something is very difficult to predict. You can predict that there'll be a shift, but the ways in which it occurs is all negotiated, you know, at a very, very small level. And what has struck me about London, I have to say, for all the years I've been studying it from afar, is the fact that it doesn't have one center has meant that these edges become even more indeterminate. You know, if you were to say, what's the edge of the LSE? Where does it end? Very hard to actually pin that down, with the exception of maybe Kingsway, but even then, masses of students crossing the other side to buy sandwiches and so on. You know, it is unlike Paris, which is a city that had a determinant center and a kind of radiating, as a kind of dropping a stone in water set of zones. London has never had that. And that's one of the interests of this project that Danny and I are thinking about, which is how can we do this with buildings as well? So that the edge of a building is not clear. You know, where does a building end and its space outside begin? But I very much appreciate your point about this. This is a particularly indeterminate city in that way. And the great danger you've had for a lot of your city planning is that your planners wanted to change that. They wanted to make it more knowable, more defined. You know, which would be, to me, a great loss of something that's particular to London.
You can ask Robert a question, Martin. Yes, absolutely. And then Jane is after you. Yes, but I don't think so.
I just wanted to ask you, Robert. William Latham has said in the lecture that accompanied that screening that. He thinks that art is dead and that basically design is dead and that both mathematics and computers and laws of biology will do it all for us. And you're inspired by scientific theory, but you don't let them take over your authorship. Do you think there's room for his kind of, would you call what he does art?
Yes, I think there's a clear definition here between,
right, between methodologies, there are certain things that scientists can do and there are certain questions they can ask within their methodology. It's a very strict methodology. And there are certain questions that they can't really ask within that methodology. Now, art is almost like the opposite of science. We can make our own methodologies up and we deliberately react against a set methodology. And for example, you were talking about having a choreographer to work in buildings who has a different methodology. And I think a lot of this is about methodology. So when one form of art dies, another one pops up. You know, if you talk to 100 scientists, they'll have one methodology. If you talk probably to 100 artists, there'll probably be 1,000 methodologies. And I think that's where it lives. And yes, I think William Mather is an artist of a particular type. And as most artists are, they are very individual in their own nature, and that's how they need to be.
Jane, and then...
They're fundamentally different. The scientist's creative process is fundamentally different from the artist. And I wondered if you and Robert maybe could comment on that. I mean, my view is that there's a sort of current way of thinking which brings those two processes together that sees them as fundamentally the same. And I was struck by you saying that they're fundamentally different.
I think the creative developments in science within science often occur because people bring together insights from different parts of the discipline, and creativity often happens when different disciplines speak to each other in all those disciplines, and that is similar in science and in the arts, I'm sure. I think it probably goes back to what Robert was saying about methodology, that there is a need for a disciplined methodology at the heart of science that you can't just ignore, otherwise there's no difference between astrology and astronomy. Now, an artist doesn't really mind if there's a difference between astrology and astronomy, perhaps, but a scientist does, deeply matters, because one is based on a construction of testable ideas, and another is fanciful nonsense, from a scientific perspective. But from an artistic perspective, they're both of equal status. So I don't mean that the creative process that leads to a new idea in either discipline is necessarily very different, but that the disciplines they work in are.
One of the things you probably will find, though, and if you read people, the philosophers like Kuhn or Feyerabend, who note this, is that a lot of the leading scientists, like Mandelbrot, mathematicians as well, actually cheated, really. They didn't stick to the very rigorous scientific methodologies, because one of the problems with it, it's so limiting. That you cannot make a scientific revolution. And Einstein, et cetera, all these big names had a lot of problem actually breaking through. So you've got lots and lots of different scientists as well. And when I work with scientists, I'm always amazed at how similar most of them are to me and how similar they would really like to be. You know, they're using hunches and intuition and all these things, and serendipity. I mean, you know, just look at penicillin, you know, it was a mistake. So you also have all those things coming into it. So chance and all the things that artists use are very useful to science, but then for a scientist to be objective, they need this other methodology. So if you put the two together, and also poets and writers and choreographers and dancers and singers, the whole lot, you get this balance then. And I think that creativity and moving forward in those areas, and also keeping it on track so we don't get a distorted view, because any one of these areas, religion or science or art, on its own, totally, you can see through history, it's become distorted, and often, you know, rather badly. So I think that's very much the case.
Yeah, I'm just trying to work out what the relation is taken to be between the art and the science camps, because it seems to be largely a kind of one-way traffic, after all. The two sisters, the fashion designer, derived inspiration from the work of the biologist, but we didn't see the biologist going around doing her work in a different way as a result of that interaction. And this relationship hasn't been clarified so far to me. It doesn't seem to me that the two types of truth that was hinted at by Mr. Freeth really it holds water, because after all, if an artist, it's possible for an artist to be inspired by some science in the way that the first speaker has been, and potentially to get the science wrong and therefore to misinform people. So there is a kind of corrigibility about art inspired by science. I think it's a good thing that artists are now inspired by science in the ways that you've listed, but it's not very clear that it's what the traffic in the other direction is, and it's also sometimes there's a presumption of scientific method, perhaps even in the case of this thing about edge and center that Mr. Sennett was talking about, the idea that placing La Marquetta in the center as opposed to the edge, whatever that is, although these are undefined terms. I mean, somebody else could have said, presumably, and may have said at the time, that, oh, you shouldn't put a market in the middle of a community, you should always put it at the edge. For demographic reasons, there are other approaches to this, surely. So rather than make an issue of edge and center as some kind of methodology, you couldn't suddenly have said to you, well, that's obvious, you need your market where some of the rich people live as well, and so on. Many questions?
I think you raise a really important point, because this often, I've been in many discussions like this, and the notion is just what you say. It is a kind of one-way street in which somehow the scientists are seen as not really to learn a lot from artists. That is, what we'd learn about biology from the art of dressmaking, right? That is a question that isn't posed. Now, I've talked to a lot of scientists about this, and they feel that in some way they're being shortchanged by the terms being put, what can a dressmaker learn from biologist, rather than the other way around. Because they feel that a lot of, it's just what you're talking about, that a lot of the categories of innovation, the processes, rather, of innovation that occur in science, in fact deal with the same kind of questing that an artist will engage in, and in some way they're models of that quest. For instance, how do you transform something from being an idea, a representation of something, to having an independent status of its own as an object? We know that very bad art is made by people who make iconic art, right? This represents a blah, blah. Those dresses don't represent science. There's a transformation that's gone on of that, and that's why they're beautiful. A lot of scientists know that, but they don't quite have the language. I talked to mathematicians about this when they use the term elegance, for instance. You know, it's an elegant proof. What do they actually mean about that? They don't have the words for it. You know, that's not been unpacked for them. And it seems to me that that's also a huge issue that should be part of your brief, which is, this proceeds in a very dumb, dumb in an inchoate way for scientists who know that they are doing something which is art-like. But they're never given the terrain in order to discover what is that art that results in a scientific revolution. It's not quite cheating, for instance. It's something more complicated than that. It's taking an irrational shortcut which produces something new. So I think your comment is to me, extremely important in this, because most of these discussions are a one-way street, which in a certain sense puts the artist in, you know, the face of all this video technology, the internet, and so on, this poor schlumpf, you know, who's got to learn a new trick, right? Rather than what an engineer might learn from somebody who knows how to do what you know how to do. Yeah, I appreciate your comment very much.
Yes, just briefly to say that I agree with that. I think there are three ways in which the conversation can work in the other direction, and you probably described the most important one, which is kind of intellectual stimulation that comes from the artist to the scientist. There are two other ways that it works in the other direction. One is rather more prosaic, which is that artists and craftspeople and designers can very often help communicate what scientists are doing to the rest of the world. And this is really important for our democracy, and it isn't easy for scientists to do it. And the third way, I think, is that in many areas, especially, say, brain science, scientists know far less than the most honest of them admit how little they know. But the public may think they know a great deal more than they do. You very rarely come across somebody like Oliver Sacks, a good neurologist who also has a deep human understanding of what people are actually going through subjectively when they have some problem like Tourette's syndrome or a problem with their brain or whatever. And he makes in himself the bridge between the subjective experience. But for the average scientist, let alone psychiatrist, the insights about what people go through when they are mentally ill and disturbed may come at a far higher level from the novelist or the artist of any of various kinds, or the musician or composer, and that must illuminate the limited sphere of exploration that the scientist at the moment can grasp. So I think there are lots of ways in which it can and should work in the other direction.
Yeah,
you have the last word.
Okay, I'll have the last word. I mean, I think there are lots of examples where it goes the other way. I mean, if you read accounts by Richard Fernaman, where he did a swap with, in that he would had a friend who was an artist, and he said, "I'll teach you about science if you teach me about art," and that led on to him really changing his methodology to using observation, which is a big part of, you know, one methodology that artists use. And also, of course, I think we forget often the influence of science fiction writers on the sciences. And most of my science friends will tell me how influenced they are by ideas that have come up in science fiction, that they've actually put a sort of material form to ideas, which then they can, you know, which might, most of them totally fanciful, possibly, but they can then give them something to aim at, an idea, etc. It's where the totally creative gives a form to the unknown, and then you can actually go about finding it. But if you're trying to actually prove something and work something out like a scientist, you have to have some idea of what you're aiming at. And to get that idea, you have to think beyond what is known. You have to go into the realm of the unknown. And the people that go into the realm of the unknown really are artists.
On a science art collaboration with my sister, which is up and running at the moment, and I'm the artist, and I think it's really important that this issue is discussed, this interaction, and I think that there are certain ways that it can happen, so that the artist can be informed, the artist's practice can be informed by the rigors and disciplines of the science. And for me, that's been a really fascinating part of the work. And likewise, to the scientists that I've been involved with, although what the project hasn't directly affected their research, it has affected how they translate their research for the public, as you mentioned. But it's also, I've noticed that it's made them expand their questioning. So a scientist has to narrow their field of research in order to produce the results that they're looking for. But in working with an artist, they can actually look beyond their tiny bit of subject and experiment around it. And that's been a really interesting part of the project. But the other thing I want to say is that I think there's room for all sorts of things in this. It's a really exciting area, the collaborations, and there's room for projects which are just inspired by science. There's room for projects which have perhaps clinical use. I think if it's interesting and exciting, we should do it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about yours? Just briefly.
All right. The current one is called Soundings, and it's is that something to do with this?
No, it's not.
Oh. It's a collaboration between the Institute of Hearing Research, based in Southampton, and I have and several different art forms, because I think there's also room for breaking down barriers, not just between science and art, but between different art forms where they definitely exist. So I have commissioned Simon Armitage, the poet, to write a new poem, a glass artist, and myself to do paper sculpture, and a website designer. And the project is designed for hospital foyers. It's in the hospital right now. And my sister and I will be doing a live event in Science Week, which will involve volunteers having the hearing test done and the result being projected across the foyer onto a 7-foot screen, which I trace from the back, which is incredibly difficult, luckily, because it looks impressive, and then building up lots of different people's tracings to give an idea of how we interact through our senses imperceptibly.
Sounds fantastic.
I'm a little worried about what we mean when we say science. I mean, most of what we've heard about has to do with engineering and technology and so on, and nothing really to do with science. And there is a kind of danger of superficiality. I mean, scientists have all this machinery and accelerators and all sorts of stuff, and images are produced. And artists look at these and say, wow, that's really interesting, and so on. But of course, those images, I mean, what the Hubble telescope turns up in the way of images has almost nothing to do with its relevance in terms of science. That is, in terms of the questions that it's answering, the explanations which it's offering, and so on. And I think the more interesting interactions are not that sperms look like this and therefore let's have the dress wave about. I mean, that's not the level which is really interesting when you think about the interaction between art and science. The level is much more at what the intellectual goal is about, what we're trying to understand here. Science is about explaining things. What scientists is a whole set of explanations. The machinery may be important in some cases, but let's not confuse the telescope with the science. That's just a tool, and I think that there is a real danger of superficiality.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure on your meaning there, but yes, I mean, there is a great difference between technology and science. And some of the work that I've done, for example, the earlier work was to deal with theories. And now it is very much using technology as well. But so much of science now has moved on that the fact you need machines to actually perceive it. And this is one of the things that interests me, is the way that those things are interpreted. Well, you're talking about theoretical physics.
Well, that's what science is.
Well,
it's a set of explanations. You may apply these explanations and use them in various ways. And I think engineering is terribly important. It's a wonderful activity. I mean, take the lunar module lifting off the moon. They designed a machine that had to work the first time in a circumstance where human beings have never gone. They had to know the gravitational pull of the moon to design that. How did they do that? They did that through what we call theoretical physics. That's part of it. That's the science. But the science alone doesn't build that machine. That took engineers, great engineers, I think, at the level of Luxor and the pyramids. I think the building of that machine was a tremendous engineering achievement. Nothing to do with science.
Actually, that's interesting you say that, because the scientists that I work with, particularly the space scientists, they always say the biggest gap here between us is actually not with artists or anybody else, it's between us and engineers. They're the people we fight with all the time, we don't get on with.
Well, it's a very important and
different
activity.
Well, I agree. I'm glad you don't devalue
engineering. Or 90%, 95% of tomorrow's world.
Well, I'm glad you don't devalue engineering from what you said a few sentences ago, that you regard engineering as a noble profession too. So let's put them together and be inspired by both.
Let's not pretend it's the same
thing. No, indeed.
Well, we've come, I'm afraid, to the end of our time. It's 7:05. I'm very sorry that Richard Sennett had to go. He was also very sorry. I thank him in absentia. Can I, however, very warmly thank Robert Riven and Martin Freeth for wonderful presentations in spite of the LSE's very advanced technological contribution to the whole proceeding. Could I just invite you all to come upstairs and have a glass of wine on the fifth floor? Do take the lift. That technology does normally work. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.